Hey everyone, and welcome back to Big Mad True Crime, where we get big mad over true crime. I'm your host, Heather Ashley, and today's case starts as a tragic mystery and ends in a horrific plot twist. Small talk sucks, so let's dive in. Bridget Prate worked her butt off. She was driven and stopped at nothing until her goals were met, whether it was her dream of becoming an occupational therapist, which she achieved, or her dream of having a beautiful family. She got married to Anthony Prate in the early 1980s. He was a successful optometrist, and the two seemed to have a really good thing going for them. They had a cute little house, nice cars, nothing fancy but nice, and they had two kids that they adored. But something was off. It might not have always been off, but somewhere at some point, things took a really weird turn. The last week of February in 2011, Anthony got home and overheard his wife talking to another man on the phone. It set him off into this weird stealth mode, and instead of just walking in and being like, "Hey, who are you talking to?" he decided to hide in the laundry room and listen. As he was sitting there eavesdropping on the conversation, he heard what he thought was his wife and this other man plotting his murder. At some point, he busted out of the laundry room and confronted the two, and who knows what he said or how he approached that topic, but in the end, he wound up calling 911 and demanding that the two of them be arrested immediately. According to the Chicago Tribune, Anthony says that Bridget was talking to this mystery man about who would get the house if Anthony died, and that she couldn't wait until her and this guy could be together, that it wouldn't be long before he was taken care of. The responding officers talked to both Anthony and Bridget, and by the end of both conversations, the police left and absolutely no charges were filed. According to Bridget, whatever he thought he'd heard was a huge misunderstanding, that she wasn't plotting his murder in the middle of their kitchen. She was just helping her friend study for his real estate exam, and the topic they were going over were the policies and procedures for when a homeowner dies. Now, you might think that thinking your wife was plotting your murder with her buddy in real estate that you think she's cheating on you with, or your husband calling the police and accusing you of plotting his murder so you can ride off into the sunset with one of your friends, would be the end of your marriage. But for these two, it wasn't. At least not then. They continued living together in the same house, raising their kids, and around 6 p.m. on March 2nd, about a week later, the couple decided they needed a new TV. They ordered the kids some pizza, got in the car, headed to the store, but this trip would not be a normal trip. On the drive to their store, Anthony claims to have lost control of their Nissan Murano, a little crossover type thing. He drove over the center line and bumped wheels with another vehicle coming towards them. When their wheels hit, the car swerved, ran off the road, and stopped between a tree and a fence, which he hit both of. The accident was chaotic and quick, but it didn't do any extensive amount of damage. The driver of the other vehicle, the one Anthony's hit, told the Chicago Tribune that Anthony's Murano swerved into his lane so quickly that he didn't have any time to react. It wasn't like he was distracted or not paying attention and just drifted into oncoming traffic. It was a sudden jolt into the opposite lane. Witnesses immediately pulled over to see if everyone was okay and if they needed anything, but what they saw was a bit of a shock. There was little to no blood, and Anthony was at the passenger side door attempting to give Bridget mouth to mouth. She wasn't breathing. Her head was resting on the front passenger seat, and the rest of her body was crumpled up underneath the floorboard. She was dead. Anthony, whose driver's side hit the oncoming vehicle, was fine, but his wife had already died. Getting weird vibes about all of this, I talked to a police officer about the accident scenes that they've been to, and it does look like they all tend to vary, and that sometimes they look like they're going to be fatal and everyone's fine, and other times the accidents look pretty minor, but it winds up being fatal. So I'll give the accident that. But when officers arrive on scene, Anthony tells them his version of events. He says that just before he lost control of the vehicle, Bridget realized she didn't see her purse or her water bottle, so she unbuckled her seatbelt to see if they were in the back, and unfortunately, that's when he swerved. And as a woman and a mom, something about this just didn't sit right with me. Anthony and Bridget left both of their kids at the house, so there would have been no reason for either of them to have opened the back doors at all, let alone for her to have put her purse back there. And purse muscle memory is legit. You grab your purse, and if you're driving, you put it in one place. If you're the passenger, you put it in another. Sure, there are times where your brain just totally fails you and you misplace something, but a woman and her purse are like a dog and a bone. So why would she look in the back for it? I mean, a water bottle would be rolling all over the place and you'd hear that. It wouldn't be much of a question. And why did she need to unbuckle her seatbelt to look? Again, for all the moms out there who've ever had to hand their kids something, take something away from them, or just go full owl and turn one whole half of your body around to address whatever insane situation is going on between siblings, very rarely do you need to unbuckle your seatbelt to do it, but Anthony claims she did, and for a purse. Anthony also claims that she was turning back around when the crash happened, so if he's telling the truth, there'd be some leverage to where she was, you know, boosting yourself up on the center console to get a good look in the back, getting on your knees to turn around, whatever, but her body didn't go into the dash or into the windshield when they hit the car, tree, or fence. It slid under the dash. Aside from the obvious questions and unique details of this crash, police also noticed something else that doesn't make sense. Bridget's airbag had never gone off. Anthony's did, but his wife's didn't. So, I did some research. Generally, if there's 65 pounds or more in the front passenger seat, the airbag's going to deploy once the vehicle hits a solid barrier if you're driving anywhere over 8 to 14 miles an hour. So even if she was turned around in the car, her body weight would have been in that seat and the airbag should have gone off, unless there was a malfunction, it was turned off, or she was never in the seat to begin with. And two of those three set off alarm bells. There were a few too many red flags when it came to this accident and stories that just didn't quite fit the scene. So to be safe, law enforcement ordered an autopsy on Bridget to see if they could figure out what happened. How did she die? And lo and behold, the medical examiner concluded that her injuries were inconsistent with a car crash. She had a small fracture to a vertebrae in her neck, but it was nothing that should have killed her. And with that, the small fracture showed no signs of hemorrhaging. According to doctor.com, we bleed around injuries to prevent further damage. Platelets stick to the source of the injury to create a kind of plug, then clotting activators come into play, and a series of chemical reactions take place to create fibrin. Fibrin creates a mesh-like network across the injury, trapping the platelets and red blood cells to clump them together and form a clot to stop the bleeding. But Bridget's body did none of that when she got that small fracture. So, the medical examiner concluded that it probably happened after she died. And unless he managed to kill his wife in the very few seconds before witnesses were on scene, that would mean that Bridget would have had to have been dead prior to the accident itself. The medical examiner couldn't find any reason that Bridget should have died and ultimately ruled her death as undetermined. This crash was investigated time and time again for months, and authorities even got to the point where they were talking about holding a grand jury to try and indict Anthony, but a second pathologist was hired to give a second opinion on Bridget's cause of death, and it somewhat conflicted with the first, and because of that, no grand jury was held. The second pathologist actually agreed that there was no obvious cause of death for Bridget, but said that the fracture may be evidence that she did indeed die during the crash, that she could have died from a fatal spinal cord concussion or positional asphyxia due to the crash. According to a study published by Neural Regeneration Research, a spinal cord concussion typically occurs when the spinal cord hyperextends or hyperflexes and generally resolves itself within 1 to 3 days without any permanent deficits. But this pathologist is saying Bridget could have possibly died from it. Knowing there was no hemorrhaging from the injury, I looked that up too. This case got real sciencey real fast. And according to Science Direct, it looks like most autopsies involving spinal cord injuries involve some kind of lesion in the central gray matter of the spinal cord at the point of impact. If that small fracture killed her, why was there no sign of hemorrhage at all? But let's get to the positional asphyxia. She was found in a weird position. Generally, positional asphyxia happens when someone's nose or mouth is blocked from receiving oxygen, or their chest is compressed to the point where it cannot expand enough to breathe. ScienceLine reports that the brain can withstand 3 to 6 minutes without oxygen before brain damage will occur. After 10 minutes, severe neurological damage is expected, and very few people ever regain cognitive function after going without oxygen for 15 minutes or more. But people witnessed this crash. People stopped at this scene. There was no 15-minute opportunity that she could have gone without oxygen and no one noticed. Unless, of course, it all happened before the crash. But what's done is done, with one pathologist saying one thing and the other saying another, and both concluding that her death is undetermined, it seemed like holding a grand jury might not result in much, so they didn't do it. Ultimately, the only charge filed against Anthony relating to the accident that may or may not have killed his wife was a minor traffic violation. To be specific, improper lane use. And according to the Northwest Herald, his only punishment was to take driving school and endure 120 whole days of supervision, whatever that means. In 2014, a private investigator was hired to take a fresh look at the accident, and he too came to the conclusion that things just did not add up. The fact that Bridget's body wound up in the floorboard, even though her seat was in the upright position when the crash happened, and the fact that her death was listed as undetermined. Generally, when someone dies in a crash, you know why. Maybe it's blunt force trauma, maybe bleeding from injuries, plenty of things, but in Bridget's case, no one, not the first pathologist and not even the second, could come to any conclusion as to how or why she died, or whether or not it was before, during, or after the crash. The PI turned over his findings to the state police, and they listened. They opened up another investigation into the crash, which was ultimately turned over to the local PD, and again, nothing came of it. So for years, Anthony just moved on with his life, continuing working as an optometrist, continuing to raise the two kids he had with Bridget, and 8 years after the crash in 2009, he met and fell in love with someone new. That someone new is 48-year-old nurse anesthetist Margaret Daniel. She had two grown daughters of her own and was in the prime of her life. She was kind, generous, and loving. She was surrounded by friends and people who loved her, and every single one of them raved about the quality of her character. But just like Anthony's relationship with his late wife, this one would also end in tragedy. On November 22, 2009, Margaret was throwing a dinner party at her house with Anthony and a couple of her neighbors. At some point during the night, the subject of death came up, and for whatever reason, this topic really triggered something in Anthony, to the point where he got up and left the room, and he left for a while. And I'm talking long enough for people to start thinking that the time he took to cool down, for whatever reason, was almost more strange than the fact that he got upset in the first place. When he finally came back into the room, he hadn't cooled down at all. He seemed more agitated than when he'd left, so Margaret called it a night. At this point, it was just getting weird and awkward and embarrassing, and they had not been dating long enough for her to be risking her friendship with her neighbors over whatever the hell was going on with Anthony. Around 11 p.m., she apologized to her guests and sent them home, which only upset Anthony more. As they were leaving, he told Margaret that she didn't need to apologize to them for his behavior. So stage one of his behavior made no sense. Stage two of his behavior got weird. And stage three of his behavior got cocky. Regardless, the neighbors went home and Margaret was left to deal with Anthony on her own, and I don't think anyone considered that his strange behavior would wind up becoming homicidal. A little after midnight, something in Anthony snapped. Around 1 a.m., over a span of 20 minutes, Anthony started making phone calls to various family members, three of them if we want to get technical, to let them know that he had stabbed Margaret. It wasn't until after those three phone calls that he finally called 911 to let them know what happened, or at least what he says happened. For 20 minutes, Margaret lay dying on her kitchen floor with no one coming to rescue her. Once Anthony finally called 911, he told the operator a story. Redneck Superman on YouTube, I don't get to pick the name, was able to get a copy of the 911 call, and it goes as follows. In the most calm and flat tone you can imagine, he says, "My girlfriend and I had a fight. She stabbed me with a knife, and I stabbed her back. I think she's gravely wounded. I'm injured too." Now remember, he's telling them this after spending 20 minutes making three phone calls telling family members what he had done. He's telling the operator that he thinks she's gravely wounded, but took 20 minutes to talk to other people before ever calling for help. And clearly he wasn't worried about his injuries being life-threatening within those 20 minutes. The 911 call continues, and he tells the operator that they're both still inside the house. They ask if he still has the knife in his hand, and he says, it's on the floor. She's not breathing. I don't know what I should do. The operator asks about the knife that she had, and he tells her again that it's on the floor, that they were both fighting with the same knife. They ask if he feels safe enough to go back inside, and he says yes, even though he already stated earlier in the call that he was inside. There's a little rustling, and he says, "Okay, I'm back inside." So either he was lying about being inside earlier in the call, or he went outside during the call and then went back in. Either way, it's an inconsistency worth pointing out. He tells the operator that Margaret is not awake. Still not seeming to be in any type of panic. There's no heavy breathing, there's no fluctuation of tone, nothing. He says she doesn't look good and that he doesn't know what he should do for her. Which is interesting because when his first wife died in that alleged car accident, he was seen by witnesses giving her mouth to mouth pretty immediately, but in this case he doesn't know what to do. They ask him how old Margaret is, and he literally cannot seem to remember. He goes, 48? Finally, he asks if he should do CPR while also being sure to add that he has injuries to his hands and arms, but he could do CPR and asks again if he should try it. Police rush to the scene while Anthony's on the phone with the 911 operator, hoping to save Margaret, but when they get there, they realize they're too late. She was pronounced dead at the scene, and according to the Arlington Cardinal, she was lying lifeless on the kitchen floor with the knife in her hand. Not on the floor, like he said, but in her hand. Anthony's wounds were nothing compared to hers. He had minor cuts on his hands and arms, while hers were all over her body. The Chicago Sun reports that she was stabbed 3 times in her chest, 7 times in her back, and had 2 deep stab wounds to her stomach, along with multiple defensive wounds on her arms and hands. With that, any self-defense argument he tries to pull out of his ass is going to go straight down the shitter. It's hard to argue that someone's attacking you when they're not facing you, let alone argue that you had to stab them a minimum of 12 times to get them to stop. Anthony was brought in for questioning as soon as he was discharged from the hospital and soon thereafter was charged with the first-degree murder of Margaret Daniel. And this charge caught the attention of the department that investigated Bridget's death, which is now being looked into again. The day after Anthony was charged, he had a bond hearing. The Arlington Cardinal reports that his attorney tried to say that Anthony should get bond because he's a contributing member of society and that this charge was just based off of a domestic incident. Dude had a wife who died under suspicious circumstances after claiming she was plotting his death, and now a dead girlfriend whom he stabbed after death was brought up at a dinner party. What are the chances that lightning struck in the same place twice? The judge wasn't having it and totally denied Anthony any bond. But he had another bond hearing in January of 2020, and this time he was given a bond amount. However, it was $3 million. The Daily Herald wrote that if Anthony wanted to get out of jail, he'd be required to pay $300,000, move in with his mommy, and would be tracked using a GPS monitor until his trial. As far as I've been able to find, it looks like that was a no-go, at least for now, and that Anthony Prate is still waiting in his jail cell in the Cook County Jail awaiting his next hearing. As any updates come in this case, I will be sure to update you as soon as I hear. For all photos pertaining to this case, check out Bridget's highlight at the top of my Instagram profile at TheHeatherAshley, and join me there tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, where you go live with me and we talk about the inconsistency after inconsistency that is this case. If you like your podcast ad-free, head over to our Patreon at patreon.com/BigMadTrueCrime, where for just one whole dollar a month, your episodes are totally ad-free. If you need more episodes in your life for just $5 a month, you get a bonus episode on the first Monday of every month. All your episodes are ad-free, and you'll also receive a forever discount code for all Big Mad True Crime merch. And of course, anytime you sign up, you get instant access to all previous bonus episodes. I'll be bringing you a brand new case a week from today, and I cannot wait. But until then, we out.